All right. Thank you so much, Joan. And welcome, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun. And you have Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson here. And Bruce is here. Good morning, Bruce. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Lynn. And yourself?
I'm just getting over a really crazy cold, really intense with lots of interesting symptoms. But anyway, yesterday I was with a fever all day. So I've cooled off today, and I'm hoping that's a permanent situation now.
Let's hope.
Yeah. Otherwise, I was going to call you off sick and say, I can't do it again today. And boy, that's it's crazy. But no, I'm here and a little sniffly, but otherwise, okay. How about you? What's going on?
Oh, just doing the usual stuff in the dreamscape here and all kinds of miscellaneous trivia to report in the world of stuff. I guess since we had last chatted, I enjoyed last weekend. They had really low tides and was doing a little tide pooling 3 days in a row, and that was kind of fun, looking at starfish and anemones and such. And had several different visitors, family and friends, and anyway, just been a busy, productive week or two, and enjoying more of the same. I'm looking forward to that. So, and particularly looking forward to chatting with you this morning because we haven't done that for at least a couple of weeks anyway. Yeah. Are you still there?
I am here. I was just coughing.
Oh, okay.
So I muted the mic.
Okay, I do that too.
I can't time the coughs quite exactly right yet. That's okay.
I know the coughs.
So tide, oh my gosh, how wonderful to have the lower tides and be able to actually go and see things. And I remember the first time I never saw the ocean. I was, the first time I got married, I was like 18. So, obviously I'd been in Alaska and seen the Pacific Ocean, but the Pacific Ocean in Alaska, a little bit different. I mean, it's, you're not so eager to be running around on the beach, doing much of anything because it's a little chilly,
It's cool here too. it's not like a Southern California beach by any means, but.
Exactly. So, but we did go to, North Carolina or South Carolina and Georgia. Mm-hmm. And, so we were in the coast along the coast there. And I remember staying at, North Myrtle Beach, which is, not North Myrtle Beach. It was the Atlantic Beach. It was, just the beach for black people. I'm sorry to say it this way. The Myrtle Beach was for white people. But I think it was North Atlantic Beach, which was right next to Myrtle Beach, was for black people. And so we had to go to that because my husband was black. And I didn't really, I couldn't even see the difference. The beach seemed the same all the way. And but I do remember going there and just being so amazed at the treasure. I mean, but I didn't, this really cracks me up now thinking about it. But, there's little seashells, little, bivalves called, coquina.
Okay.
Which are like little clams, little tiny little clams. Yeah. Well, they were so gorgeous and all these bright, beautiful colors. And I just loved them. And so I went and just collected hundreds of them. And then and they were still alive, of course. I was, unconscious of the properties of life at that time. So I just took them and I put them in the, in a bag in the shower of my room and, let them, well, basically they couldn't live. So I let them die. And then, I put them in a bag in my suitcase and brought them back to Colorado with me. And so I had this bag full of really stinky, dead little seashells.
Mm-hmm.
And but I used them.
I can imagine.
But everybody laughed at me. They were like, oh, she is so cute. She's just like a little kid coming around here you know, picking up seashells like a little kid. And then the other thing that was like hugely, hugely impressive to me, not about the beach, but about the people that we were with. We had, lots of music and dancing, and I remember dancing, and someone said, "She sure doesn't dance like a white person," which made me feel like really flattered. Oh my gosh, I'm so wonderful. But that was back in the days. This was in the 60s. So this was in the days when racial tension was still pretty high. And, well, what am I saying? It's today, too. I think even worse now because of, things that have happened. But at that time, and of course, I've told you the story. I was arrested several times while I was in South Carolina, Georgia.
I don't recall that. Maybe I missed that.
So. Because we were traveling around, we were trying to get people to sign up to vote. And when they seen us in the county, then, the sheriff would come. And then the sheriff would, pull us over and ask for our, IDs and everything like that, and then just tell us to get out of their county, which is basically what we would do. But then one night we were going from South Carolina to Georgia. I don't remember how we were going. Anyway, we were going by Edisto State Park. I remember that real well because they pulled us over and we all got arrested. And after we got that all cleared up and, proved to them that we were not, they didn't think this. They said they thought that we were burglars and that we were traveling around the counties and burglarizing people's homes. So that was obviously not true. They arrested us and then they let us go and told us to get out of the county, which is generally what they did. Get out of my county. And so we got out of their county, and as we were right as soon as we crossed the county line into the next county, guess who was sitting there? The county sheriff. And what did he do? He pulled us over, obviously. And it was so funny because we knew that the guy from the other county had called him up. He had slipped his uniform on over his pajamas. So his pajama bottoms were sticking out from the underneath of his uniform pants. And I mean,
there's a clue, huh?
it was quite comical. But then he basically arrested us and we went through that whole drill again and, had nothing, did nothing. So they had to let us go and they sent us to the next county. So we kind of missed that particular county. But that was kind of typical. I recall we were staying at a kind of a safe house, in someplace in Georgia. So I can't remember. Anyway, we're staying at a safe house and, I was taking a nap and, someone told me, came over and showed me, "Wake up, wake up," and I got up and we looked out the windows and we had the whole house had been surrounded by the KKK.
Oh, boy. Wow. That must have been a little adrenaline going on.
In full regalia, right? And, of course, that's, they didn't do anything. They just stood. They just stood and threatened, basically. And after a while, they left. We didn't come out. We didn't say anything. They just left. But I had some quite great adventures back in my teenage years. When I was young and restless and out, out being crazy in the world. But, anyway, they never kept us in jail or anything. And, nothing ever really happened. But at that time, they had some pretty bad attitudes. Still do, but.
Well, that was brought to my attention the other day when we watched the Hidden Figures movie, which I thought was excellent. Have you seen that one, Lynn?
No, I've heard about it though.
Oh, it's really good. I think you'd very much appreciate it. It was kind of eye opening because I guess certainly a lot of the media paints a picture of the whole. I mean, in some of the media paints this picture that, once slavery was abolished and segregation was outlawed, that was pretty much done deal over with, this, yeah, and your story obviously recounts that isn't the case. And you know, this Hidden Figures movie, which is very well done and very heartwarming, and fun in places, as well as, you know, sobering to realize that, you know, as you pointed out, and our news media has demonstrated, there's still, you know, especially with body cams in the last few years, still a lot of crazy stuff going on and, you know, racism and just, it's just, which to me is just a part of the insanity of the belief in seemingly separate selves. And I think that's, you know, the core idea that we all need to look at that within ourselves is that we think that it's possible for us to be separate from anyone or anything else and from what we would call God. That if that's even possible, then we're living in insanity. And that's just one demonstration of it, isn't it? I mean, and you've got to experience that very firsthand compared to a lot of other people anyway. Myself anyway.
Yeah. Oh, that. And, you know, it's just crazy too. I mean, the depth of hatred that runs through people for no reason whatsoever. Because I think I have talked about this, that when I got married and, the man that I married was, African American. Uh-huh. And my entire family, basically, except for my mother, disowned me. They said, you know, might as well never come over, never see us again because, you know, you've done something that was outrageous to them. It was outrageous to them that I would have done that. And, I just could never, you know, I could never figure it out because, I didn't see a difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the thing. I didn't see a difference. And, except
because you were looking beyond the superficial.
Yeah.
And anything in this world is superficial, which I think, you know, is really something that we all have our pet specialness things. And you know, if for some it may be racism, for some it may be, you know, classism, for some it may be, you know, gender inequality, for some it might be, you know, political or social, you know, some other social, you know, arbitrary social distinction or species, you know. Some people treat animals and vegetables as if they have no, you know, aren't deserving of respect, you know. But I think it's back to this fundamental, choice of the two thought systems, isn't it? I mean, ultimately.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's an idea that somehow or the other, the physical things that appear to be so different make a real difference between what we are. And as long as we believe that, and it's everything. It's not, you know, just race. I mean, it's everything. And, you know, anything that I can look at you and say, wow, he could never understand me because he is so different than me. Or I can never understand you because you are so different than me. And that's, you know, I think of all the things in this Course of Miracles that Jesus teaches, probably the most important thing is this idea of sameness. Because, you know,
exactly.
You know, why does he say, you know, in Christmas as the end of sacrifice, say, make this year different by making it all the same. You know, he's talking about not making a difference between anything, animal, vegetable, mineral, wood, anything and anyone, not making anything more important than anyone, not making anyone more important than anyone. It's basically saying, look for the sameness. And in our lesson, I think yesterday, not yesterday, because yesterday was a goodie too. I think the day before, all things are echoes of the voice for God.
Uh-huh.
That's really what he's talking about, is that if I see it as an echo of the voice for God, and I see it as all being the very same thing, just appearing in multitudes of forms, then anything and everything that comes to me, including I'm getting over a quote unquote terrible cold, even that is an echo of the voice for God. And what is that echo? What is that voice for God saying to me in everything? Come home. Look what kind of a crippled life you have. Look how hard it is for you. And look how easy it would be if you would just come home. Mm-hmm. And that's what everything is saying. You know, if you look at all the things around you, look at your computer as much as you love it and all the things that it can help you do and all the things that you can do with it. It is a, basically, it's a filter. It's a, what do you call it? It narrows down your vision so that you give each an individual thing a meaning that says, I can only talk to Bruce if I'm on my computer, because he is a separate being that's in another state. And so thank God I have this computer because, you know, it's the only way I can communicate with my brother. And Jesus is, you know, tells us throughout the course, you know, those are, those things that you're using are not, they're not help. These are veils. These are things that keep you more, they separate you more and more and more and keep you more and more apart.
Exactly. And, and that's if we use those things as propaganda for ego's belief system of separation, but we can also use any technology or anything that's in the material world as a way to see beyond the illusion of separation and differences and, you know, using this example, racism that you were just talking about, that, you know, gives us the opportunity to see that we are all in the same boat. We're all the same. And we're really, truly one being, but we get to that awareness by seeing the shared interest and the sameness.
Exactly, exactly. And so seeing the sameness is really easy with people. You know, I have never met a person that I couldn't actually relate to mm-hmm. in some way or another because of our shared experience.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, you could meet somebody that could be, seem to be the most evil person on the planet, like Hitler, say, for instance. And yeah, you could probably sit down with Hitler and get into a great discussion about art. You could probably sit down with Hitler and get into a great discussion about many things and see your relationship to that person and see that you and he are not any different other than the fact that, you know, I particularly am not going to kill millions of people, but you know, that's not really, that's pretty meaningless when it comes to my brother.
It is. Yeah, and I think I love how Ken Wapnick distills it down. He says, you know, we can see in the simplicity of this, we can see that we're all a tripart being, if you will, that we have a decision-making mind and two thought systems, one that's of inclusion, one of exclusion that we're all working with. We have the Holy Spirit and the ego, two words for the inclusion and exclusion thought systems, and this decision-making faculty in the mind that's basically is constantly choosing between those two. And the irony, of course, is that's really the only choice that is meaningful, but the choice that we usually make is between illusions instead of between illusion and reality. And there's countless illusions, and as egos, egos will do anything to make an arbitrary distinction among illusions or between illusions important rather than choosing reality. When we were talking about this racial issue, it kind of reminded me of a classic Star Trek episode, which I'll post on the recording. It's called "This Let This Be Your Last Battlefield," and it was one of the original Star Trek series episodes that had Frank Gorshin, who was the Riddler on Batman.
Yes,
and,
right.
Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I think it was just such a classic. I have a frame on YouTube frozen here that shows Nichelle Nichols, who played Lieutenant Uhura, who, you know, broke history in the 60s by being one of the first black woman, I think, to, you know, be a part of the crew of a starship anyway. Not sure how many other places she, you know, made history, but in terms of television, but the plot of this movie was that there was, they found this planet that had been decimated by a huge civil war, and without giving it too much away, which if you've already seen it, you know what it is anyway. But
might as well.
Yeah, I mean, but the end. You see these two characters that were beamed up from the ship, where there were the two lone survivors, and they're at each other's throats, and apparently they're the last two survivors of the civil war, and despite the fact that all of their culture has been completely destroyed except for these two representatives, they're still at each other's throats. And not until the very end do you see them side by side and realize that the only difference between them is that one of them is black on the left and white on the right, and the other is white on the left and black on the right. And I mean, what a silly and ridiculous difference. But actually, I thought it was a profound reminder that every difference that we make, you know, just like the People's Front in Judea or the Judean People's Front in Monty Python's movie, you know, it's all those differences are ultimately silly. But we need sometimes stark examples of that to point out to us how we make distinctions a big deal, and we make that our reality, and we identify with it, and that that identity then becomes the thing that keeps us in this prison in our mind. And so anyway, I'll post a link to that clip.
Also, that's a great idea. I also, now that you bring up Star Trek, have you seen the great controversy over, I think it's a new Star Trek movie that's coming out, and people are complaining because there are not enough white people in it. People are complaining because the main characters are multiracial people of all different races, and there was a big poo-hoo about, you know, where are all the white people? And
you know, just as a point of reference, when I was out tide pooling, because I was referring to that a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. last weekend, I did not see a single sea anemone or starfish or beach, you know, crab on the beach holding up a protest sign saying, where are all the crustaceans and the invertebrates and as heroes of my superhero movies, you know? None of them were protesting that, so I don't get it.
I don't get it either. But anyway, enough of all this. I guess, you know, you kind of see, I've had a history in my life of being really outspoken and vocal about, you know, what is happening with these people that I, you know, because I didn't see a difference. I know I told you that, you know, when mine was, you know, two, maybe two, 3 years old, and I didn't even own a doll. I had no baby doll at all to play with. My sisters thought it was terrible because I was always playing with the boys. So my sister took me to the store to buy a baby doll, and there was this little black baby. Her name it was Amos Andra. It was a doll that was during the time of Amos and Andy, very popular guys at that time. Who were black guys dressed up as black people. But that was another thing, blackface. But anyway, they had these little baby dolls, and I wanted that doll. And my sister was like, no, you know, you don't, you know what? And she kept showing me other baby dolls, and I'm like, no, I want that doll. So, and I threw, I guess, such a fit that she ended up buying it. And so that was my doll. That was my baby. And she was this little black baby, and she was so gorgeous. If you ever want to look it up, it's called Amos Andra is the name of the doll, and there aren't very many of them in existence anymore. But that doll was like my, you know, she was my talisman. I took her to school on the first day of school. If the teacher asked us, you know, if you were going into space, what would you take with you? And I said, you know, my doll Barbara, my baby Barbara would come with me if I went to space. You know, I was just, you know, I didn't see anything other than that was my baby. So, my family had a fit about it, but, they couldn't take her away from me, and I wouldn't, you know, I didn't see the difference. To me, she was beautiful, and she is they're gorgeous little dolls. They're just so gorgeous.
Yeah. I think I just found one on Pinterest here.
Aren't they cute?
Yeah.
Their little face and their little rosy cheeks and their little
lips
and just, yeah. Who wouldn't want that baby?
Adorable, yeah.
But that was, I think, the very first of any kind of racial dolls that were made for public consumption at that time.
Huh.
So not like Black Barbie who came along later in the 60s. But anywho, let us go to our reading for this morning.
Yeah. I think well, it kind of fits in nicely because we're talking about the material world, and I think this fits really nicely.
Okay. Well, I'll let you read, and
I
will cough and sneeze while you're doing that.
Okay. We're going to start with today with question 1297. 1297 in the frequently asked questions for the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, as we've been doing for quite some time. You can go to facimoutreach.org, which is a little shortcut. It saves a couple of steps. If you just go to facim.org, you can find it through the supplemental and materials and get to that, the question and answer service. But you can go directly by going to facimoutreach.org and then clicking on the complete list of questions. And if you click on the last list and then scroll down to number 1297, you'll get to it directly. And I'll read the summary, which they give at the top of the page, is: how do we live in an illusory world if matter doesn't matter? I sometimes shorten that to matter doesn't, and just figure that the other matter is implied, right? Okay, so I'll read the whole question now. Question 1297. I was sitting in the library one evening and noticed a certain book glowing. There was just something about it that made me know I needed to read it. So I took the random book and it turned out to be A Course in Miracles. Well, we're actually showing a glowing book on the new website, by the way, for the Foundation for Inner Peace. So that'll be fun. I've spent much time over the last 6 years not only studying the Course, but also other spiritualities, philosophies, and thought systems. I've reached the conclusion that nothing in this universe actually exists except in the minds of people. Woohoo. Right on. I absolutely do not believe in matter. Okay, just don't tell that to the police officer that pulls you over, or your boss, right? One of the really humorous Muji videos said, you know, that this guy was starting cracking up. He says, "Yeah, I realize I'm not here." And Muji says, "Well, yeah, just don't tell that to your boss, you know, because he'll say your paycheck doesn't exist either." Okay, I absolutely do not believe in matter. I believe if we had mass consciousness believing along the same lines, this entire world as we see it would disappear and the sunship would become reunited. Don't get me wrong, though. I do believe that all works of good that a fellow brother does for another will be remembered for eternity in God's mind, but everything else will be erased when full atonement is achieved. And I'll read the second paragraph. This is a two-paragraph question here. Until the majority of the sonship has realized this, we are bound to this illusion of matter. So the question remains, how do we convince people in such a materialistic world that matter doesn't matter? How do we convince people who put so much faith in their bodies that their bodies are illusions? And for those of us who understand these things, how do we live in an illusory world recognizing the absurdness of it all and pay attention to the illusion to some extent, i.e. not getting run over by cars, walking naked down the highway, etc.? Because it sounds as if the more we play in the illusion, the more strength we are adding to that illusion as well. I firmly believe that this is the next logical evolutionary progression of the Course. What do you think of what I consider to be the evolution of Course in Miracles? You know what? As I'm reading this, I think we might have actually done this one. But that's okay, unless you'd rather pick another one.
I think we did, and actually I do remember this, because I remember the glowing book and all that. But you know what? Let's do it anyways.
I think we'll probably come at it from a different angle.
Yeah, because there's been a lot of stuff. People have been coming up with a lot of stuff about what is illusion, what am I doing? So let's do
exactly,
it.
Okay. Exactly. I'm gonna combine it with the other recording, and we'll just make it a larger coverage by coming at it from some different angles. Yeah. Do you want to read the first paragraph of the answer or comment on the question? Or I can.
Okay, you are breaking up on me.
Oh.
I'm a little bit, but that may be fine. Okay. So do you want me to go ahead and read? Did you read the second paragraph?
I did.
Or do
I
you
did.
Want yeah. me? Okay. Okay.
Comment on the question?
Yes. Yes, I do. So first, you know, just a little mention of all of these things that this person is talking about the majority of the sonship realizing things, and how do we convince people and all that kind of stuff. You know, that's scary territory for me, because, you know, it comes to the point where I feel like I'm taking responsibility for someone else's salvation. And, like, somehow I think I should be in charge of what you do, and I'm going to do whatever I can to convince you of how to be. And, boy, have I done that myself. Whoa.
Oh, yeah. I think we can all raise our hands on that one. But that's I think, a quintessential example of ego's level confusion and its propaganda trap of thinking that if I can just change what appears to be outside me, then I can, you know, it'll be the cause of what's going on inside my mind, and then I can be at peace. Well, no, we've got it backwards. We have to choose to be at peace, and then what happens in the world doesn't matter. Ultimately.
Exactly.
But that's a challenging lesson. So I think it's probably a good thing that we're rereading this, because I know I need to learn this at a deeper level. And I suspect maybe others who might be listening could say the same thing.
Exactly. And you know, this is, again, a really good example of level confusion and getting the cart before the horse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see. I just had an interesting long discussion with someone on Facebook about physical miracles. And they were saying that, you know, Jesus wants us to be miracle workers, and we need to be making physical miracles like he did, as in changing the nature of physical material and raising the dead and healing the sick. And so they're concentrating on, you know, how do I do that? And, you know, I was trying to convince them in my own rightness that you don't do that, you know, that what you do is you become identified with the Christ. And as you are identified with the Christ, that is the only identity that you have is the Christ, then of course you will be miraculous. You could do physical things like heal the sick and raise the dead. You can do anything because you recognize that the material world is not reality, and you're, you know, in control of it. However, if you are recognizing that the material world is not reality, then why would you want to change things? Why would you want to heal a broken leg? Why would you want to raise the dead? Why would you want to do those things if you recognize that what you were being shown was an illusion?
Right.
You just, yeah.
And I guess the answers that come to mind is there's two responses that immediately happen with any question. And there's the ego's response, which, you know, as the Course says, is speaks first and is always wrong. Meaning that's as we've trained ourselves to relate to an ego thinking, an ego thought system. The knee-jerk response is, oh, well, I've got to fix the dream because the dream is what's affecting me. But the Holy Spirit's interpretation is there's nothing wrong with doing that, but your motivation could now become sort of fear of being at the mercy of or the victim of circumstance. We can now be merciful to ourselves and everyone else we meet by seeing that the world has had no effect on our peace, and therefore that's what we're teaching ourselves, and by osmosis, any mind that tunes into that wavelength is resonating with that idea instead. So
exactly, and so really, it's just to return your thinking to the source, return your thinking to the place. That's all these lessons are about. This is all everything is about, is returning your thinking to the thinking with, excuse me, with the Holy Spirit, with God. And, you know, I think the main thing the person was arguing about was the idea that the miracle is a shift in perception. And it was because I think they didn't recognize how powerful a true shift in perception is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read the section in the Course, there's many of them, but the section called From Perception to Knowledge, there's two of them right there in the same section or the same chapter that are talking about, you know, what's the problem with perception, and what's the difference between perception and knowledge, and what can I do if I'm working out of perception versus what can I do when I'm working out of knowledge, and is a completely different. I mean, there's that shift makes every difference. It makes all the difference in the world. And so, you know, as Jesus is talking to us about, you know, change what you think you see, change the way you're seeing things, and it will be very clear to you what to do, when to do it, how to do it. You know, listen to my voice. And really, that's all he's saying. You know, don't make up your own mind about what you're going to do. Just ask for guidance at all points. Mainly, you know, two reasons. Probably the first and most important reason, which I'm not going to say no one understands, because that, you know, I think no one does understand if you really think you're living here in this world. But, you know, the whole point of this whole tiny man idea, vast illusion, is that it was something that happened long ago in an instant. It happened in a moment. And all of its effects, everything, were left in that place, in that moment. And all we're doing is reviewing the story. We're watching the story that we made up when we had the tiny mad idea. Can I change the story? Can I change what happened long ago? Can I go back and reopen that package and say, oh, well, wait a minute, God. You know what? I had this tiny mad idea and I thought things would be real, but I'm not real sure I like this reality. So let me go back into the dream and rearrange it now. And, you know, God said, no. No, no, no. That's what the Holy Spirit is here for, is to put the miracle behind everything that we invented in that tiny mad idea, so that we can, like Easter eggs, we can find them as we go along. And our perception shifts and shifts and shifts and shifts until what we are seeing is closer to reality. We'll never reflect reality because it is a dream. But closer to reality, to the point where we can see the reason, the purpose behind things. But not to, there's no way, no way that you're going to go back to that tiny mad idea that happened long ago and rearrange and change it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, at that moment, you know, God just said, no more. You know, no more. You cannot continue to make illusions. I let you make these, and here you are. You got them. Don't try to change them. Don't try to rearrange them. Don't try to make them different, because this is what you asked for. Not that God is saying those things, because God doesn't even recognize that this is happening or appears to be happening. But the whole idea that somehow or the other I would want to go back and reopen that package, and, you know, it's like Pandora's box. You know, it's like, you know, okay, everything's in the box now. All this bad stuff is in a box. Right? You can look at it, you can think about it, you can access it, but you can't open it up and go in there and change it, because they'll all come out again. You'll have a big mess.
It's a dream box, and as long as we inhabit the dream and think that we're the dream character, we're going to keep trying to rearrange deck chairs on a Titanic scale, and it's just not going to work for us, because that ship is doomed, because it's a dream. It's not going to float, and it's not going to hold water. You know, it's just not going to work. So, yeah.
All right. Yeah. So
I like how you shared that, Lynn. That very eloquently stated. Yeah, what you just said. We do keep trying to rearrange things, don't we? And it's just part of ego strategy to keep us mindless. As long as we can fixate on dream figures, including our own, and think that that's where our peace comes from, we're never going to be, you know, with that thought system at peace. And I think it's important to recognize that the two thought systems, while, you know, completely consistent within themselves, are mutually exclusive, because they don't have any overlap. And guess what? Just one of them is completely insane, and the other is completely sane. and we kind of have, you know, I get a clue, like you say, we get these little Easter eggs moment to moment. We see in every situation, in every opportunity, moment to moment, there's a choice that can be made to see that we're all in this together, that all-inclusive quality, and that everything here is the same because it's all a projection of a dreaming mind, and it can all be brought back to the Holy Spirit for that correction to that inner kindness teacher who just says, you know, don't be dismayed because none of this happened. You know, in truth, not in the reality, the seeming reality of the form, but in truth, nothing happened to destroy the oneness or the holiness or the innocence of God's Son, which we all are. And that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Hang on just a second.
Sure. Shall I read the next paragraph?
I'll go ahead. I just had a cough.
Oh.
All right. So so the answer starts with, A Course in Miracles is clearly teaches that the world and the body are illusory, and the world will disappear into the nothingness from which it came when we are no longer want the purpose it serves. And the quote from the teacher's manual, when not one thought of sin remains, the world is over. It will not be destroyed, nor attacked, nor even touched. It will merely cease to seem to be. And that's from chapter section 14 of the teacher's manual. And also, there's some lessons and things that are quoted here. The world thus is not the problem, as it is nothing but a projection of the mind. The outside picture of an inward condition, that's from text chapter 21. The Course, therefore, teaches us to look within at what is causing us to project outward and identify with the form the projection takes. That is the core of its teachings and mind training exercises. That's perfect. This is, this particular sentence, I think I would just copy out and paste everywhere. The Course teaches us to look at what is causing us to project outward and identify with the form the projection takes. That is the core of its teaching and mind training exercises. So simple.
Exactly.
Yet, you know, we would do anything other than that. You know, we would go to John of God to see miracles. We would, which I don't, you know, you can go John of God. I don't care.
I know people who have done that.
I know many who have. You know, it's okay too. It's cool. Mm-hmm, if that's what you think is going to help you. And I can almost guarantee you that the only thing that's going to help you from any of that is the joining that you do with your brother throughout, you know, everything that you do. I mean, if you get, you know, you're getting on a plane to go see John of God, and you're, you know, complaining to the people at the airport that they shouldn't have rules about how much luggage you can take, or you know, complaining to the people on the airplane because they don't let you get up to go to the bathroom when you feel like you want to because the seatbelt sign is on, or you're angry with the person who's sitting next to you on the airplane because they chatter the whole way. You know, you think about your process. You know, you're going to see some miraculous person, and yet, and I'm not saying people are doing this, I'm just saying in general, this seems to be a trend that, you know, people do tend to bitch and complain, be upset, you know, worry about the driver and the ride and the dirt on the roads, and, you know, worry about, you know, complain and bitch about everything that's going on. And then, oh, well, you know, now we're going to be holy and go see this holy person who's going to heal us. I'm telling you what, that's completely the opposite of what Jesus is telling us. He's telling us every single person that you come in contact with is your brother. It is a holy encounter. Every single relationship with you have with the stewardess on the airplane, or the person who's bringing your luggage, or the driver who's driving you, the relationship that you have with those people is the miracle, mm-hmm. not nobody else is going to give that to you.
Everyone and becomes our savior. So
yes,
yeah,
yes. And so if I'm doing that mindfully, then what do I need to go see John of God for? What do I need to do anything for? Because I'm mindfully watching my thoughts and practicing forgiveness And Jesus tells us forgiveness is everything. It's the answer to every question. So, you know, you're sick and you need healing, practice forgiveness. You know, you're...
Right. Having said that, and I totally get where you're coming from, Lynn, I think it's also good to remind ourselves that everything we do in the world that's motivated by changing the world is magic, ultimately. So you know, going to, like I did the other day, to a podiatrist because I thought I might have broken my toe. Yeah, that's magic. But I recognize that the people, like you're saying, in the reception office, the people who I passed on the highway, and, you know, the people I'm likely to meet doing a little physical therapy are equally the saviors, because and the people who empty the trash for the people who do the physical therapy. I mean, it's there's no difference, because it's all the same. We're all in the same two thought systems, and we all have the choice moment to moment to see that everyone has that essence that's all of spirit within them, and equally amenable and serviceable in terms of, you know, providing us the insight that we're all one being. We all have the same shared interest of going home together, as Ram Dass says.
Exactly. And if that's your focus, then all you're doing is looking at what you're projecting outward, and looking at it, and just as all things are echoes of the voice for God, if I'm looking at it as, you know, this dry, dusty road that's making me sneeze is not a very good thing, instead of, this is an echo of the voice for God. You know, I don't have to justify it. I don't have to do anything. All I have to do is know that's what it is. It's not the voice for God, but it is the echo of God's voice that is reflecting back to me. And so, you know, I can love the world. I can love my situation. I can love my cancer. I can love my cold. I can love my broken leg. You know, not like, oh, I love you, you know, but just actually look at it and recognize, you know, this is God talking to me. This is God talking to me. And if I can learn to listen, I may hear what I need to save myself. And, and then healing comes naturally, which we hear in a lot of places. And that's what I think people are just trying to get the cart before the horse. They think that they're going to be able to do miraculous healings, and yet they haven't healed their own mind. Their own mind is unhealed. And, you know, this person is telling me, I have done miracles. And I'm like, okay, then. I guess you don't need the course if you're already doing miracles.
And everyone gets that recognition in different ways and different times, and we all arrive at the same point. And in truth, we're already have arrived. We're already home, but we're just dreaming that it's taking us this finite amount of what we call time, which is part of the dream, to get back to where we never left. Pretty strange, you know. What a long, strange trip it's been, as they say, right?
Exactly. So you want to go for the next paragraph?
Sure. Early in the text, Jesus talks about the difficulty of getting through to us. How can you teach someone the value of something he has deliberately thrown away? He must have thrown it away because he did not value it. You can only show him how miserable he is without it, and slowly bring it near so he can learn how his misery lessens as he approaches it. This teaches him to associate his misery with its absence and the opposite of misery with its presence. It gradually becomes desirable as he changes his mind about its worth. I am teaching you to associate misery with the ego and joy with the spirit. You have taught yourself the opposite. You are still free to choose, but you can really want the rewards of the ego in the presence. Oh, but can you really want the rewards of the ego in the presence of the rewards of God? That's from chapter 4 in the text, section 6 and paragraph 5. The pedagogy of this course is well thought out. It meets us where we are and respects the choices we have made to dissociate ourselves from truth and love, while at the same time it shows us the disastrous consequences of those choices. It is never coercive or threatening, however, just abundantly clear about the mess we have made of everything, including our self-identity, why we have done it, and how to undo it all. Its approach is gentle and encouraging, reassuring us that there is no urgency. as ultimately time is unreal and we are undoing what never happened, the principle of the atonement. Everything we need to restore our minds to the awareness of love's presence is already in the Course. And, of course, in our minds, because that's where the Course exists. We're just remembering that it's always been there. For those whom this Course resonates, nothing more is needed. Other paths are available to those who are not comfortable with this one. And then it refers to Section 1, paragraph 4 in the manual. So a quick comment as far as the contrast. I think that's such an important concept, because if people are reading A Course in Miracles over and over again, which I've been doing now for a few decades, you keep discovering that the approach is, as Ken Wapnick points out, it's like a symphony where he shows different themes and then he goes back to them, but it's this sort of cyclical thing where there's an opportunity to see the contrast in different ways and different coming up from different angles, but it's almost inevitably each section of the text, for example, and quite a lot elsewhere in the workbook and the manual as well. The emphasis is just let's look together at the insanity of the belief in duality and separation and specialness and the substitution that we've made for truth, and see how it has not served us and not made us happy or peaceful or remember that we can afford to relax and trust and not freak out about the world. But we need to bring that darkness, that insanity of believing in the dream as reality, to the light. And I think that Star Trek episode because we don't see the difference as really the same until the end of that episode, the guy who's black on one side and white on the other, and the other who's white on one side and black on the other, we don't see the differences until they're brought together. And together, the insanity is obvious. And I think that's part of the genius of that particular Star Trek episode, but also the genius of A Course in Miracles. We don't do that by trying to bring the light into the darkness, because the light doesn't work in the darkness. Kind of like Einstein's thing of you're not going to solve a problem from the level at which you made it, because, I'm paraphrasing, of course, because within the level of the dream, all there is insanity. We have to consciously choose through that awareness within us, that decision-making faculty, to see that there's another, a better way, as Helen and Bill said to each other. There's got to be a better way, and we can choose that, which is choosing the reality that is independent of all seemingly illusory choices, and bringing that darkness to the light, bringing the insanity of the ego right on the same altar in the mind with the Holy Spirit's real alternative, which is this gently glowing, uncoercive, peaceful, like a lighthouse that shines, forever. And then the light dispels the darkness, because just like as you wake up from a dream, you realize, well, that had no sense to it. It didn't mean anything. And that's why those early workbook lessons, I think, are so profound, is nothing that the ego tells us means anything. None of the differences among illusions. There's no order of difficulty among them. So, because they're all the same. It's all the same propaganda. But we typically take a long time to come to that conclusion. But we have these little epiphanies, like these Star Trek end of the episodes where we say, oh my gosh, that's the same illusion. There's, it may have a slightly different form, but the differences are so trivial in truth that they essentially are nothing. The differences are nothing, and that the sameness is everything, and that's the Holy Spirit's message. That's the reflection of the oneness that gets us home. So, anyway,
exactly. Yeah, absolutely, and so it's that looking for the sameness, and it doesn't take much. If you just sat down and talked to any person you met on the street, any person you saw ever, and had a civil conversation with them. Mm-hmm. You would find out that you and they are no different at all, and that, they have the same exactly. concerns, they have the same hopes, they have the same fears. Even the most craziest person you think you ever met is going to sit down and talk to you, and you're going to find out that you are just like them in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And our samenesses are so much more pronounced than our differences, and yet we look at, you know, which half of you is which color instead of, you know, you and I are identical. If we looked, if you looked in the mirror, you would see the opposite, wouldn't you? And then wouldn't you see yourself as being what you hated? I'm not sure. Anyway.
Yeah, that's true. In that episode, that they probably had a bad time with mirrors because of that optical flip flop. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that.
That thing again. Oh my god!
Really? They, no mirrors were left on the planet when they beamed up too. Probably. Huh? That never crossed my mind. That's interesting.
Okay, so let's go on to the next paragraph. I mean, this one is, I mean, there's just so much juice and all this stuff.
Oh, there really is in there. Yeah. I like to say, when I first realized we were repeating this one from a previous conversation, it's like, well, you know, I need to hear it again, so maybe someone else will benefit from it too.
Exactly. So let's look at the next paragraph. And I'll tell you what, I'm getting really annoyed with this new Windows because it put my email on here, and now it pops up, every email that I get pops up here. So I'm like, I don't want to see this stuff. I'm trying to read something, and I need to shut that off. I'm not sure how, but I'll figure it out. The course often addresses the concern, to use your words, of how to, quote, live in an illusory world, recognizing the absurdness of it all, and pay attention to the illusion to some extent, for instance, not getting run over by cars, walking naked down the highway, etc., unquote. That's from her or their original thing. So lesson 155, which is coming up tomorrow. Is that tomorrow? Tomorrow is 155.
Yeah, right? I think so.
We're at 154. Lesson 155 teaches us, for example, that there is a way of living in the world that is not here, although it seems to be. You do not change appearance, although you smile more frequently. See, this is what happens when you have this shift in perception. You do not change appearance, although you smile more frequently. Your forehead is serene. Your eyes are quiet. And the ones who walk the world as you do recognize their own. Yet those who have not yet perceived the way, and there we are talking about perception, those who have not perceived the way will recognize you also and believe that you are like them as you were before. And this is what Jesus happened to Jesus, right? He became identified with the Christ. His own people didn't know the difference. So to them, he was just the same old guy. And although they thought the same old guy was great, they didn't see the Christ. If they saw the Christ, then you know, the story would be completely different. But all they saw was their buddy Jesus, who appeared to be pretty high up there, and they didn't recognize what he was or that they could be what he was. So anyway, there's also a section in the manual of teachers that describes that discusses this aspect of our process. How should the teacher of God spend his day? And that's a really interesting little section in the manual for teachers. I did want to mention, and I'm not going to go, you know, into this too much here, but for those who are using versions of A Course in Miracles that are not the Foundation for Inner Peace, do not have, I believe, the clarification of terms, mm-hmm. which is extremely, extremely helpful. I mean, it's like,
oh, it is, it is.
Bong, it's what turned on the lights for me, for sure.
Yeah.
So they don't have the clarification of terms that describes, you know, things the way that, you know, Jesus, you know, what the meanings of things that Jesus is giving to things, but also they don't have the psychotherapy pamphlet, nor do they have the Song of Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Song of Prayer came about because people already had the course and were already misusing it.
mm-hmm. Yeah, Ken describes that in Absence from Felicity, I believe.
Yeah,
how basically it was sort of a response to the inevitable fragmenting of, you know, the ego of course, will take a hold of anything, including the Course, and use it for its purposes, which is to separate and to divide and to fragment. And so there's already this idea that, well, okay, I'll pray for things in the world. No, not so much.
Exactly.
that wasn't the idea here. The idea is, and I love that. That's what, and since you bring that up, that one of my favorite and probably the favorite line in that whole Song of Prayer pamphlet booklet is the secret of true prayer is to forget the things you think you need. I think that's just such a succinct and beautiful reminder that you know, we've given this world all the meaning that it has for us. So why would we want to pray for things that we don't really need, or at least be willing to look at the way that ego uses prayer and recognize how insane that is. And just kind of, if whenever we can, just recognize with a little inner smirk or a little inner smile, it's like, okay, there it goes again. There's the shenanigans that ego's up to that I know are not going to do it for me. But I'll watch that. And the more we watch it, the less we begin to identify with it. And then eventually, I think that actually does filter down to our behavior. And, you know, we stop going there altogether in some respect. It doesn't mean we don't do the things in the world that, you know, like brushing our teeth or taking care of client projects and you're going to work or you know, helping around the house with projects that need to be helped on, you know, all that kind of stuff. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that we don't take them as being the pivotal things upon which our happiness and our well-being depends, because we realize that anything that we do in the world ultimately is just a reflection of what thought system we've chosen, and you know, or at best. but where the real peace comes from is the choice of the thought system.
Exactly. And you know, I was just thinking about even the definition of miracles, which, you know, since we are so caught up in seeing it as a certain thing, then it's hard to see it as something different. And that is one thing that, you know, I mean, I think it was, I'm not faulting Jesus, because I have no idea how important it is. It may be very important. It may really have, in fact, it has really helped me to switch my my identification with certain things or my definitions of certain things based on what Jesus tells me in the Course. And it has made a huge change in my perception. The idea of a miracle, I don't see actually healing the sick or raising the dead as being really a miracle, because when you look around the world today in society today, you see hundreds, maybe thousands of examples of people doing these physical healings or these you know, raising the dead and that kind of stuff. I mean, that's what this guy kept saying. Well, look, there's a YouTube video that shows this and this and this. And one I thought was really hilarious, and I did go and look at it, was this healer, right, who people in the audience, after they've been healed, suddenly they have, where they had rotten teeth, now they have gold caps, or they have, you know, fillings or whatever. And so, you know, people are all excited, oh, my teeth are healed. And yet, you know, what they've done is, you know, they've obviously had dental work done. And you know, my question to the guy who was saying, isn't that great that, you know, God would give these people fillings and gold caps and things? I'm like, you know what? If that was God's doing, that was ridiculous, because God would just heal your teeth.
Have they been praying for a transient dental medication?
I guess so. God would not give you gold caps, or God would not give you fillings. God would give you new teeth that were whole. You know?
Well, yeah, I guess it all depends on, you know, where we draw the line of what's miraculous, because, you know, I was watching I came upon a movie that reminded me of one that I'd seen a year or two ago that I thought was really interesting and thought-provoking, called Her. Have you seen that one?
No.
Actually, it's the voice of Scarlett Johansson and Joaquin Phoenix. Joaquin, the main character. Anyway, but anyway, he basically starts having this relationship with this artificial intelligence on his smartphone, and they've got, you know, it's a futuristic kind of sort of, I guess it could be a dystopian future because of the way it. Anyway, but it's a really interesting film, and it kind of reminded me of the robotics thing, the clip that I saw on Jimmy Fallon's show the other day, but all this stuff, you know, we think that life begins with the fertilization of a human sperm and egg or whatever species we, you know, want to extend that to, and then death is when suddenly those vital processes that are measurable no longer register on our instruments, kind of thing. But that's basically based on a spatial temporal frame of reference, which of course tells us, well, okay, if that is so, then you're really betting on the wrong horse, because the life that can come and go, that's finite, that's subject to the whims of you know, what happens in the material world, how could that be truly called life if by, you know, using the adjective truly, it's related to truth, and if, I guess for me, it's always made sense that if truth is true, it's always true, forever and ever, eternally. And if bodies come and go, how could they be true? How could anything that has a birth, a lifespan, and a death be true? It can maybe reflect the truth, but it at best, but it's certainly not true in and of itself. And I think that's where we make a huge mistake. Which isn't to say, again, that we, you know, don't do the things that are appropriate in terms of taking care of our bodies and helping our family to do this and friends do the same and you know, and going, you know, however far we need to go to help and be truly helpful, which is really, you know, almost back to the mind again. But anyway, I'm kind of rambling a bit, I guess, but hopefully that's helpful. Because it's helping me remember that's what I need to keep focused on is the choice in the mind always.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's it. So you want to go ahead and read the next paragraph?
Sure. I think we're on the one that starts with the main point, right? The main point is that a mind identified with love appear to others in a form that could be accepted without fear and to which others could relate in a normal way. The mind's purpose or content is the key factor, not the behavior. There we go again. The mind's purpose or content, not the behavior, not the form, not the cells that come together after a sperm and an egg unite, that then aggregate more molecules that then become this thing we call life, and then finally crap out at the end because, you know, that's non-sustainable. It's interesting. I'm going to do a quick aside here. I used to be really into the environmental music, and I still try to do what I can to, you know, recycle and minimize my energy consumption, all that kind of stuff. But it's no longer something that I'm obsessive about. Maybe as obsessed as my wife would probably say. It's just interesting to just kind of look at what's truly sustainable, because, I mean, that's one of the big words in the environmental movement is sustainability. Well, ultimately, this planet is not sustainable because it has a birth and a death, you know, in terms of, you know, it will eventually be engulfed by the sun if the sun becomes a red giant or whatever, or supernova. I think there's different kinds of ways in which suns perish and the planets that are around them that may be sustaining biological life as we know it. But anyway, it just kind of is, again, it's part of that whole silly dream drama of thinking that things that can be sustained for a longer period of time are better than things that are sustained for a shorter period of time. But it's all finite. It's all ultimately, you know, dust to dust, ashes to ashes kind of thing in the dream. But the best part, which is the real alternative that the Course talks about, is that we don't have to identify with it. We can identify with the shared interests that bring us back to the mind And because minds are joined and ideas don't leave their source, we're all one being together. And the ecstasy and the joy of recognizing that and tying that into seeing, you know, the Savior in everyone, and the gratitude that we feel for that is huge. That really is the light that is the contrast at the end of each section in the text, for example, that Jesus is wanting us to recognize, to say, well, okay, this false alternative is not cutting it for you, but the real alternative is there waiting for you after you get the special love and special hate out of the way. And it'll be there automatically. You don't have to do anything. That third step of forgiveness is just getting the heck out of the way.
Exactly.
Recognize and release. It will be replaced automatically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start that sentence again. The mind's purpose or content is the key factor, not the behavior. Many Gnostics deliberately disobeyed the world's laws to prove that the world is not real. Well, by fighting against the world, they prove just the opposite. If you are clear about the difference between form, behavior, and content, mind, you would be able to live in the world and abide by its rules without reinforcing the illusion in your mind. The body, and this is a quote from chapter 18 now, section 6, paragraph 4, the body was not made by love. And there we go, that's the biological thing. Yet love does not condemn it and can use it lovingly, respecting what the Son of God has made and using it to save him from illusions. So I think that's the different choice in the mind that sees that it's not the form that's important, it's just the use that we make of it in our mind. And then in parentheses it says, Kenneth Wapnick, and well, I'll just add his last name, presents a detailed examination of this confusion as found in Gnosticism, the ascetic traditions, and other approaches in two of his books, Love Does Not Condemn, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil According to Platonism, Christianity, Gnosticism, and A Course in Miracles, and The Message of A Course in Miracles, Volume 1, All Are Called, and Volume 2, Few Choose to Listen. He shows how the Course avoids the pitfalls in different moral traditions, leading to a formulation of a non-normative or new morality, which is, you know, the normative thing is basically making light try to fit the darkness, that ever-present level of confusion that the ego attempts to pull off by making a big deal out of the behavior in the form and saying, okay, well, let's bring the light here into the form and make the form work. You know, let's make the dream work for us. And, well, no, it's essentially dysfunctional, or as Ken says, you know, it's a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem, once again, huh? So, anyway, good stuff there, huh? We can use the body lovingly. We can use the dream of the world lovingly and everything in it, and by being gently respectful of everyone's seeming choice of thought system, realizing that by allowing everyone else that choice, we allow ourselves to make that choice more consistently. Okay. You want to read the next paragraph?
No, I just was having trouble getting back. Anyway, it's interesting he talks about the Gnostics. And you know what? When I was younger, I had this whole idea when I was like 15 or 16 and I was camping in the woods up above Boulder, which I did a lot. I hung out with a lot of people and we did a lot of stuff. Anyway. This was the 60s. It was Boulder. Hey. I was meditating one night and I just got this whole idea. And I remembered, the devil, according to the Bible, had tempted Jesus and said, you know, you could just, you know, jump off of this thing and fly. You wouldn't have to fall. And I almost did. I almost said, okay, I can do that. I can just, you know, step off of this, you know, big cliff. And I'll be fine. And I decided not to. And I'm glad I did, because I recognize now that would have been a foolish mistake on my part. But I probably would have, you know, ended up in the hospital or something, or dead. So, but I always thought, you know, when I had kids, I'm not going to teach them that the world is real. I'm going to teach them that this world is not real. I didn't do very good at that. It didn't work at all.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that. I sometimes reflect on, you know, how I did just about everything wrong with my stepson when I got together with my wife. So, but that's okay. But now we're you know, great friends, because I think, you know, over time I recognize all the craziness that I was trying to foist upon him, speaking of free will, and realizing, you know, what a great savior he was for me. You know, of realizing that if I try to impose my will on someone else, it's going to backfire. And of course it did. And then once I let go of that, you know, it's kind of like my flying teacher says, you know, that if you trim up the plane properly, which is what preparing our minds does, metaphorically, the plane will basically fly itself. You know, you just have to get your hands off the controls and it'll fly itself if it's, if you set it up properly. And that's what this curriculum does, is it sets up our minds so that we don't really have to do much other than just be ready to provide that little willingness to look at the craziness with the Holy Spirit and see our investment in it disappear.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'll go into the next paragraph.
Uh-huh.
And so he says, A Course in Miracles surely is not the final word in spirituality, as it is directed to those on the bottom rungs of the spiritual ladder, that, for example, all of us. But those of us who have accepted as our path home, it is more than sufficient, which is why Jesus says at the end of the 365 lessons of the workbook, this course is a beginning and not an end. We spend the rest of our lives applying its teachings to our personal lives. Doesn't mean we need to go find another guru. I'm done with my 365 lessons. I better go see Muji now. You know, he's saying just do what it tells you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go anywhere else, you know, but if you do what it tells you, then you will awaken. We spend the rest of our lives applying its teachings to our personal lives. We needn't try to convince others to change how they go about their lives. Our focus is exclusively on how we choose to perceive others and the world. Therefore, seek not to change the world, but choose to change your mind about the world. There's another one of these shifts in perceptions that he's talking about. Our only responsibility is to accept the atonement for ourselves. If I do that, then I know everyone has done it, because the sonship is one. As long as I believe that others still have to do it, my mind is not yet healed. And that's a huge point. As long as I think there's somebody else, something else, something, then it means that I'm just still seeing differences.
Mm-hmm,
I'm mm-hmm. seeing the same.
Yeah. That is a huge point, because sort of the theoretical one is like, well, okay, unless everyone else on the planet or in the cosmos is enlightened, then I won't be, because I'm contingent on them. The way that trickles down to our everyday things is if some family member or some coworker or some politician I see on the TV doesn't believe the way I do, then I can't be at peace. I mean, that's basically, you know, the kind of more general kind of typical thing of how that manifests is we basically, you know, think that our peace and our awakening, if you will, is contingent on something else happening or not happening in the world, and we're back to level of confusion again, aren't we?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's just a vicious cycle.
mm-hmm.
Okay, so therefore, do not seek to change the world, but choose to change your mind about the world. Our only responsibility is to accept the atonement, not to go out and heal your broken leg. If I do that, then I know everyone has done it, because the sonship is one, and as long as I believe that others still have to do it, my mind is not yet healed, because I'm still perceiving the sonship as fragmented. As long as I'm seeing others, I am seeing fragments. and you know, people think, you know, well, how am I going to, you know, not see others? Well, I know exactly how it works, because I've been able to see that. It takes effort to look at another person who appears to be outside of me and to join with that person and to accept that person, everything about them, without trying to reject them or change them, mm-hmm. But just accept them as they are and love them as they are and join with them as a mighty companion in a holy relationship, all that kind of stuff. you know, that's what I need to do. I don't need to do, you know, you don't need to do anything else. All I need to do is just do the things Jesus is telling me to do, and then everyone else will do what they're supposed to do. That's just the way it is. So, so this is a major difference between the course's teaching and your belief that, quote, if we had mass consciousness believing the same lines, this entire world as we see it would disappear and the sonship would become reunited. That was the quote from the reader. This is not true. Mm-hmm. It's not possible. Mass consciousness in belief of the mass consciousness is what brings about Holocausts. Belief in the mass consciousness is what brings about all the stuff that's going on in the world right now.
And a property of matter is mass. So if we believe in matter, then the mass, which has to do with a percentage of a divided universe that has this sort of critical mass, as it's called, or a proportion that is the tipping point, that we think that, well, the real tipping point is in the mind. It has nothing to do with the world of form. And the tipping point really is just a symbolic reminder that at some point we spend more of our time on average, thinking along the lines of the Holy Spirit's inclusion and shared interests and forgiveness and recognizing that if I, kind of to what you were saying a moment ago, if I can remember to see, it doesn't mean I don't take the photons that come into my eyes and try to deny that visual or auditory experience, or my sensory data, but it just means that I'm willing to not condemn everyone or anyone for what my eyes and my senses would want them to convey, given to the hands of, you know, the ego for interpretation. So if I can remember that, would I condemn myself for this? And you know, would I see, would my choice be to see my brother's innocence? And that's really what it boils down to.
That's it exactly. That's all that it boils down to. So
yeah.
That's a lot simpler than trying to change everybody's mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A lot simpler. Let's see. Did I finish this? No.
Interruptions.
That's quite all right. I appreciate it. If this were true, there would be actual parts of the sonship, and some would be victims of others because these others still choose to remain separate. That is decidedly different from the entire thrust of Jesus' teachings in the Course. Again, that is actually the opposite of what Jesus is telling us in the Course. Is somehow or the other, you know, we need to, some parts of the sonship need to be saved and other parts of the sonship are not. No, you just have to look and see that we're all the same. We're all in the same place. We're all in the same boat. We're in that same boat, brother. And if you rock one and you're gonna rock the other, it's the same boat, brother. That's it. It's the same boat. So let's stop rocking the boat and, start actually doing our work, practicing forgiveness. And as we're practicing forgiveness, all these things become very, very clear. There's no more need to change the world. There's no more need to change my brother. There's only a need to see my mind, have my mind be at peace, and to see the love that's everywhere, the voice for God.
Exactly.
So you want to read the next paragraph? Why don't you finish this up here?
Sure.
Short paragraph and then a little bit longer.
Okay. This last two paragraphs begin with one further thought about A Course in Miracles and its quote, evolution, unquote. It is impossible for a brain/mind as limited as ours to fully understand this course, which comes from a mind that transcends time and space entirely and is without limit. That, again, is why the course teaches that our only responsibility is to accept the atonement for ourselves. And boy, that comes to mind frequently when I realize, you know, the importance of trust and the importance of realizing that, like in the Manual for Teachers, it says, you know, that not only is judgment not a good idea, but it's basically impossible in truth, because we would have to be aware of such an inconceivably vast, collection of data that we don't have because of our identification with our bodily vehicle, and it's limited data that, you know, sees one octave out of possibly an infinite number in the electromagnetic spectrum, the red through purple, violet spectrum, and we hear maybe 10 octaves, and we occupy a little fragment of time that maybe lasts a century if we take good care of our bodies. And I'm saying we in the bodily identified sense, not the we that of course would use in the collective Son of God sense. And then, you know, we maybe occupy a meter or two of space, in a cosmos that appears to be, you know, vastly larger. And yet there's vastly, you know, we're vastly larger than almost infinitely fragmented particles that make up our bodies. But it's just kind of a crazy making, dream that we made up to keep us mindless because we thought we somehow shattered the peace of God and destroyed perfect oneness, threw God under the bus. And that none of that happened. We didn't pull that off in truth, but we need to practice forgiving ourselves for believing we did. And seeing our brothers and sisters sinless is how we get there. That's how we get there. Okay, so I'll finish the last paragraph here. Finally, there is a lovely passage, seems more like a song Jesus is singing, that blends with your belief that, quote, all works of good that a fellow brother does for another will be remembered for eternity in God's mind. We quote in part, and this is one of my favorite parts too. We oftentimes read this as a meditation in our Wednesday night online study group. And with the tip of the hat to Terry Miller, who does a great job with this. How can you who are so holy suffer? All your past except its beauty is gone, and nothing is left but a blessing. I have saved all your kindnesses and every loving thought you ever had. I have purified them of the errors that hid their light, and kept them for you in their own perfect radiance. They are beyond destruction and beyond guilt. They come from the Holy Spirit within you. And we know what God creates is eternal. Yeah, this is one of my favorite quotes from the Course. So anyway, we just read FAQ number 1297 from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles question and answer series. This has been Lynn Johnson and Bruce Rawls, and I always like to remind people to go to acim.org and facim.org for the kind of the two definitive places for A Course in Miracles teachings and information. And I also have a little blog that's acimblog.com. So,
excellent. And you will post, and he does post these recordings on acimblog.com as well as interviews that you do with Susan Dugan, Carol Howe.
I haven't done with Carol Howe yet. I've done one. That'd be a good idea, though. I'm hoping to meet her in July. I'm thinking more and more about going to that conference for the one that's to benefit the Foundation for Inner Peace. That's
the one in
Utah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. She'll be there. She's a lovely.
Yeah.
Lady.
Yeah. I've enjoyed what I've heard of her work. I have done more recently, and we're doing this about twice a month now, conversations on Jackie Laura Jones' Blog Talk radio program, and then also a monthly program with C.A. Brooks, who has a every other week program on A Course in Miracles on 1-2 Radio. And a few others here and there, I'm a little still quite backlogged on the ones that you and I have done, Lynn. But I will get those up on the website too. But there's plenty of others that we've already done. So
yeah. I know, so I'll send you this one as soon as I can remember. And thank you.
And I'll combine it with that other one that we did on the same FAQ.
Very cool. All right.
Well, thanks so much, Lynn.
And thank you so much, my love. Thank you. It's been great to hear you, and looking forward to next week. All right.
Yeah. Have a great week.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.